So good afternoon, everyone. And so I will give a discourse, give a talk for maybe 3/4 of an hour. And then you can stretch your legs for a few minutes. And then we have a discussion, question and answer session until three. Okay. Right. So. So I shall give a talk about a subject which you may be somewhat familiar with, and that is the five hindrances. What is wisdom? Wisdom is the vision of things as they are, seeing things in their true light, and the condition for wisdom is samadhi, and samadhi is the clear stability, bright, sharp, stable state of mind in which the habitual tendency to move towards or move away from phenomena is temporarily annulled or anesthetized, and that samadhi is dependent upon a stream, a continuous stream of mindfulness, which is, in turn is based upon right effort, and that right effort is based upon faith. So faith here is not faith in dogmas, but there are two principles which you need to adopt, at least as working hypotheses. And one is faith in the law of karma, and the second is faith in the human capacity for enlightenment. So these two things are, in fact, very much connected, in that the Buddha proclaimed his teaching as being a teaching of effort. By proclaiming it to be so, he denied that or made it clear that his teaching was not one that accepted that everything was fated to happen, was due to a divine will. Things don't happen at random, but there is a constant flow of change, which is dependent on causes and conditions. And in the moral sphere, in the human sphere, it means that human actions are meaningful. Human actions are meaningful because they have results which harmonize with the ethical nature of those actions. The most simple presentation of this idea is good actions have good results, bad actions have bad results. In order to understand this, it's important to recognize that what the Buddha is referring to essentially is wholesome and unwholesome, skillful or unskillful states of mind, which is to say, every time you act with a skillful state of mind, you immediately increase the power of skillfulness in your mind. Skillfulness increases through thinking, saying, doing things skillfully. And similarly, unskillful, unwholesome bad qualities in the mind become more powerful, become stronger every time you act, impelled by or guided by such unwise, unwholesome intentions, volitions. So everything exists as a flow. That flow of phenomena is not random. It's not preordained. It cannot be affected by ceremonies or prayers. But there is a logic to it, if you like, of cause and effect. And that's the first basic premise that we need to adopt in our spiritual life as Buddhists. Second, as I say, grows from that or is related to that, and that is that human beings are able to discern and to distinguish between the wholesome and the unwholesome. We have within ourselves the capacity to abandon the unwholesome or the unskillful, to practice and to develop the skillful and to purify our minds. And that because we have that innate skill and because we can develop that skill to a very high level, we are capable of freeing ourselves from suffering and realizing ultimate truth, which is one and the same thing as we call true happiness, or a Buddha called Paramang Sukhang. So these are two ideas which give us a firm foundation in meditation practice. Which in this, there are causal processes. We have the ability to recognize these causal processes, and we have a window of opportunity in which we can produce certain causes and conditions affecting this flow in a salutary way. So in meditation practice, what we're doing is we are looking to train the mind, and the mind is not yet in a position, or it doesn't yet have the qualities that it needs in order to be able to see things clearly. So this is our intention. We are practicing in order to create the conditions for a clear understanding of the way things are. The strategy is to give the mind a very simple task, very straightforward task, of sustaining attention on a particular object. Let's take the example of the breath, for instance. Now, one of the reasons why the breath is such a popular and effective meditation object is that it's not particularly interesting. Now, we can sustain attention on a movie or on a piece of music or various different kinds of entertainment because the stimulus from outside creates a bond. We don't have to do any work. We can just float with that. We can just follow that, be drawn by that stimulation. So although we can spend an hour, 2 hours, or 3 hours, perhaps, completely absorbed in some kind of entertainment, it doesn't count as mindfulness or samadhi because there's no effort involved. All the the power is coming from without. Now, in order to sustain attention on the breath, you have to be creating that energy yourself. You have to be committed to that meditation object, because there's nothing in it which is innately interesting or exciting. And this is why it's such a good object, because it's a challenge. How do you sustain attention on an object which doesn't invite intention, your attention? It's not immediately attractive as an object of mind. So understanding our intention in meditation, our goal, our rationale, so on, these are important foundations, as I mentioned just now, because these will sustain us in this practice. Now, when we try to give the mind a single focus in this way, then the mind reacts. It doesn't like it. It goes against the grain. And the obstructions or those mental habits which prevent us from sustaining attention on the breath, are gathered into five different hindrances or nivaranas in the Buddha's discourses. Now, when these hindrances arise, many people can become discouraged or feel that they don't know how to meditate, they can't meditate, or they doubt whether they're doing it wrong or whether they're not cut out for meditation, and so on and so forth. But it's really important to understand that in the first stages of meditation, particularly, this is in fact the intermediate, the preliminary goal is to expose these habits of mind, because we can only transcend something when we understand it, when we've seen it clearly. So by going against the stream of habit, we illuminate that habit, and then we learn how to deal with it. Now, these habits or these hindrances or obstructions do not, of course, arise as a consequence of meditation, or it's not that they only arise during meditation. They're there during our daily life, but because there's so much going on in our life generally, they're much more difficult to identify, except when they appear in very extreme forms. Excuse me. So just as if you want to follow a moving object on a screen, you make a blank screen to make that job easier, then formal meditation requires us to simplify everything, to take a particular posture and to close our eyes or to shut down as much extraneous information, sensory stimulus, as we can in order to be able to track the movements of the mind more easily. So the arising of hindrances is the work to be done, and there's so much to learn. So meditation is not struggling with hindrances so that we can experience something called peace or whatever, but the whole practice is awakening. Awakening to the mind, awakening to reality. And in the beginning, we're awakening to the reality of the hindrances. Excuse me. So these five hindrances, we can go through them one by one. And the first one is the will towards sensory world of form, sounds, odors, tastes, physical sensations, ideas. And I think that a phrase that comes to mind with sensual desire or desire towards objects of sense is basically better the devil you know than the devil you don't, or most basically something is always better than nothing. If you have if your mind wanders off into some particular theme, it's not just running around wildly, but it settles into something. It might be a thought of food, thought of some entertainment, thought of sex, thought of anything that is enjoyable. The moment we think of that thing, we can just settle into it and enjoy it. And that's a refuge for the unenlightened mind. Now, when we can't escape from the unpleasant or the frightening or the unknown physically, we seek to escape it mentally. And the most common way is to bring to mind some image, some thought, some train of thought, some matter or other, which gives a kind of a warm, comfortable, pleasant feeling. So everyone has different kind of default refuges of this nature. They don't have to be expressly sensual or sexual. It's just anything at all that when you think about it, you feel good. You feel just a little bit good, not specially good. You know, you might be thinking about some sport or some movie or some this or some that. You just have the kind of that kind of warm, kind of comfortable, familiar feeling. You know, like an old armchair. You know, you settle back into, and that's and to recognize. So we're not sort of saying this is a bad thing. This is what we do. This is our strategy that we all have in life. We have these certain trains of thought, certain things that just make us feel comfortable when otherwise we might feel uncomfortable. So by giving the mind a job to do, to keep it on the object, then we're exposing this, we're recognizing this. Oh yeah, I do this a lot, you know. When I feel uncomfortable or bored or sad or something, just try and think of something that sort of cheers me up or makes me forget that thing for a while. So in meditation, the breath not, as I say, immediately entertaining, interesting, and for all meditators, there's a moment where you get bored. You're not getting enough stimulation from the breath. It's not exciting and interesting enough. So the mind looks for something more interesting. And that tends to be this object of desire, which are crafted from experiences of the senses in the past or anticipated experiences in the future. One of the important ways in which we can prevent this from occurring is by creating a positive attitude towards the meditation object, and creating a feeling of enjoyment or appreciation of the meditation object, to prevent the mind grasping onto feelings of dissatisfaction or boredom with the breath. So that might involve taking a very in the beginning, taking a real interest in the particular nature of the in breath and the out breath, its relative lengths, its coarseness or its fineness, whether the breath is coming in the left nostril or the right nostril, whether the in breath, the out breath are of equal lengths or different lengths, using different mantras or creating a different way of being with the breath. I mean, if we try to force the mind to be with the breath, then we won't be very successful. So we can consider it the practice of meditation of one of learning to appreciate like the subtle beauty of the in-breath and appreciate the subtle beauty of the out-breath. Because if we do look very closely, it is rather beautiful. It's just not, you know, immediately or obviously so. We can also use practice of loving kindness and just create that sense of kindness and love and project that onto the sensation of the breath. So we may consider the practice of one of enjoying the in-breath, enjoying the out-breath. So not looking at I'm concentrating on my breath, because that immediately tends to bring up a sense of tension and stiffness in the mind. But how can I enjoy, how can I appreciate this simple experience of an inhalation? How can I enjoy or appreciate the experience of an out-breath? So in this way, by consciously seeking to find a way of relating to the breath in which you you feel some immediate emotional satisfaction, you're cutting off the likelihood that the mind will wander off into the realm of memory and imagination. The other helpful point here is to make a clear determination at the beginning of meditation session that you will not spend time thinking about this or thinking about that. If you've noticed that there are certain things that your mind tends to indulge in, tends to like to think about, you've noticed this on a number of occasions, then you just remind yourself, you know, this meditation, you know, you're not going to think about this, you're not going to think about that. So it's right there in your mind. So if your mind does start to move towards that memory, that fantasy and imagination, then the mindfulness will come up much more quickly. The second hindrance is of that of ill will. And this, again, is a very common reaction to the frustration of meditation. And when we realize that we can't use willpower, we can't accomplish it in the ways that we can accomplish so many other tasks in the world. And the frustration that you can't do it, even though you want to do it, and your mind keeps wandering off, and then the sense of self-aversion that arises, that's one of the hindrances. Or you project that outwards, and you project it on the people around you, the teacher, the place. And this is a very useful opportunity to see the impersonal nature of ill will and how ill will, aversion and rejection and reaction arises and then seeks for an object. You know, the assumption is that there's something there deserving of ill will and the mind latches onto it. But often we can see the ill will arising first. Of course, one of the most obvious occasions for ill will to arise is with physical pain. And meditation gives us the opportunity to see how much discomfort, physical discomfort, is really a reaction against the pain rather than the pain itself. And learning how to distinguish between physical pain and mental reaction to physical pain is one of the great gains of a meditation practice. So recognize again the same practice of creating an enjoyable and sustainable relationship with the breath will prevent ill will arising to a certain extent, being realistic and recognizing that this is a very difficult task and one which takes a long time and doesn't respond to our agendas and timetables, and just being forgiving of yourself for not being able to do this in the way that you'd like to do it. With these first two hindrances, generally just coming back to the breath very patiently, recognizing a hindrance as a hindrance, and coming back very patiently and gently, firmly, beginning again, 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 is the most basic and effective practice. But if one of these two hindrances arises continually and in one particular form again and again over a long period of time, then it's necessary to put down the breath and apply a particular antidote. In the case of the first hindrance, developing a meditation on the unattractive side of sensory experience. In the case of a strong sexual fantasy, for instance, we notice that sexual thoughts tend to be based upon a very selective view and memory and perception of the physical body. So we introduce into the mind the elements of the physical body which are not attractive to balance the mind out. So if that train of thought, you know, is based upon a very selective and distorted view of the body, as it generally is, then that will be a very effective way of dealing with sensual desire. So it's good to develop this practice and have this in your toolbox of meditation techniques to supplement your main practice of, in this case, of breath meditation. So if you go through the different parts of the body, for instance, and you can visualize them, or there's one particular part of the body or you find, when you think about it, you just find, ugh, that's disgusting, then you make that an object of meditation. So it might be phlegm or mucus or urine or one of those parts of the body that you don't generally think of when you think of someone you're attracted to. And then you have that as an image or as something that you can bring to mind just to calm the mind down or balance it when it's getting caught up in its very distorted and one-sided view of human body. Similarly, if the mind is full of ill will, it's tending to distort the view of oneself and others and focusing too much on the negative side. And so we balance the mind again by consciously introducing into the mind positive thoughts and thoughts of kindness and compassion. And this is a way of, because these hindrances are based upon a distorted view of the way things are, we don't try to drive them out of our mind or feel that we're bad for having these thoughts. We simply readjust our vision of ourselves and others by consciously bringing to mind all those elements of the situation, of the person that we are suppressing in this hindrance. third hindrance is of lethargy and dullness, sleepiness. So it's like physical and the mental aspect here. If there's a physical aspect, you just feel no energy, you know, just it's just completely collapse, you know, just completely nothing, no kind of energy in the body at all. Or as the mental is like this kind of swamp, fog, dull kind of soup of mind, but the mind is completely lacking in any flexibility or direction or energy. So these are different aspects of this chronic lack of energy. And this may be due to physical factors, it may be due to illness or lack of sleep, but we can observe that if we feel we feel exhausted and run down or sleepy while we're sitting in meditation, and then we get up and we feel exactly the same, then it's probably a physical thing. But if you only feel like that while you're meditating, and then you wake up and you get up and you're just normal, you don't feel that way, then it's most likely a hindrance. The hindrance it has many different causes. A few very briefly. Again, if we are, and I think it's very common these days to be overly stimulated. There's just so much going on and so much to attend to in our life, very, very busy life, that when we radically cut down our interest, and particularly just to one object, to a not particularly fascinating inhalation and exhalation, the mind can't cope with this sudden reduction of information. The only time that usually happens is when we go to sleep. So the brain tells us, oh, it's time to go to sleep. So in some cases, if you're struggling with this hindrance a lot, and this applies to the next hindrance also, then we need to look at our daily life and whether we need to simplify and reduce the amount of information and stimulation in our daily life so that we're not addicted to that level of things going on, that we can't deal with a sudden reduction from it. But there's also a case where we have this idea of peace, that meditation will take us into this beautiful, peaceful, relaxed, calm state of mind and make that the goal of meditation. And so after initially struggling with a lot of mental agitation, as that mental if you persevere, that mental agitation becomes much diminished, and a certain sense of ease and calm arises in the mind. Now, if you started your meditation with the idea that ease and calm is the goal, or that's what meditation is for, as meditation is about, then you will tend to grasp on to that reduction of mental agitation and lose your mindfulness and become dull and sleepy. So it's come from a wrong understanding and a wrong view of meditation. The word Buddha means the awakened one. And so the essential feature of all Buddhist meditation techniques at every stage is the sense of wakefulness. So you're wakeful with regard to your breath, wakeful with regard to hindrances. And as the hindrances begin to diminish, you are wakeful, you are aware. It's not a matter of just sort of settling back into that kind of peaceful, pleasant state of relaxation. So we're looking for a middle way between effort and relaxation, and constantly having to readjust or recalibrate the intensity of our effort as the mind develops in meditation. So the other thing that can often happen is that if there is something very uncomfortable or something in our minds that we don't want to look at, we don't want to face, then as the meditation starts to get close to that particular state of mind, then the mind just shuts down or shuts off as a way of preventing us having to be aware of that. So there are many different layers and levels of this particular hindrance, and in its more refined level, then many people would probably call that samadhi or meditation. But the defining factor that distinguishes that kind of stillness from samadhi is there's a stiffness in the mind. If the quality of the trained mind is very firm and strong, but it's also incredibly flexible. One of the qualities of the trained mind samadhi is that it's ready for work, meaning it's ready for the work of wisdom. So if the mind is still but it's stiff, then that's and it's not the right path. It's still one of the hindrances present there. One of the similes for the mind, which is well developed, is of copper wire, which can be bent in any direction that we see fit. So the mind becomes like copper wire. If the mind is just like butter and just out of the fridge, which you can't put on your bread very well, then it's still a hindrance. Fourth one is agitation and remorse. So mental agitation, monkey mind, running here, running there, running all over the place. I think you all know about that one. And so here's how you deal with this one. If you find the mind just going crazy and just catch it, in the mind you have words and images, okay, or only images or only words. But if you can catch a word or a sentence or even an image and then repeat it, consciously repeat it. So let's say after we get out of here, go and eat some noodles, and then you catch your mind, and then you don't say stop thinking about noodles, go back and be with your breath, and catch your mind saying eat some noodles, and then you repeat it, you make it like a mantra, eat some noodles, 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 and in a very short time you get bored with that and you just let it go. So it's, you're not sort of letting it go because you've got to be a good boy or a good girl and you really should be meditating, but you let it go because you don't want it in your mind anymore. Another way is to imagine these words as written in water. So without you doing anything, your mind automatically sees those words dissolving in water. So you want a way of dealing with mental agitation in which it doesn't feel as like you're doing something. Well, that tends to make it worse. So these are skillful means of dealing with mental agitation. The second leg or the second part of this hindrance is remorse, and that means going over and over again things you did that you shouldn't have done and things you shouldn't have done that you did, and feeling guilty. So guilt is a hindrance to peace of mind and wisdom, intelligence, and it doesn't mean that you're responsible and you're a good person because you keep telling yourself off or punishing yourself for something that you did in the past. It's a sense of recognizing this as a memory, and in the case that we have done unwholesome things in the past, and then the practice is one of taking responsibility, revealing this to a good friend or a teacher, making amends wherever is possible, making a firm determination not to act in that way in future, and then to let go. And so when thoughts of bad things, with stupid things we've done in the past, pop up in meditation, don't feel that you shouldn't let go of these, that it's irresponsible, or that you're getting away free. That is a deluded way of thinking, and will keep your mind caught up with the hindrances forever. So just let it go. Then the fifth hindrance is doubt. And doubt about the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, so many different things we can doubt about. Many reasons for doubt. One is that spiritual supermarkets, so many different things to choose from, and we want some kind of guarantee that the amount of time and effort we're putting into this particular teaching, this particular way, will bear some fruit. So we want some guarantee beforehand that we're doing the right thing, that this is correct. But there's no such guarantee. You can't ever have that. So if you're always looking for that and doubting whether you've got that or not, and whether then your mind will be caught up in the hindrance. If you want answers to things with the rational thinking mind, which can only be answered through experience, then you'll still be caught in doubt. There's only so much that you can understand through thought and logic. So here is a matter of looking around, studying, listening, comparing, being very circumspect, and then making a choice as to a particular path of practice, and making a commitment for a certain length of time, 3 months, 6 months, or a year, and then at the end of that time, reviewing and seeing whether it is really the path that you need to follow. This is not something that you can be reviewing at the end of every meditation or within a meditation period. Having, as I said, done the preliminary study and making a choice, and then sticking with that choice for a certain length of time, is a way of dealing with doubt. So these five hindrances, the Buddha said, the first one is like being in debt, the second one like having a fever, the third one like being in prison, the fourth one like being a slave, and the fifth one like being lost in the desert. And when we realize, when we are aware in the present moment that these five hindrances are no longer present in the mind, then it's the sense of someone who has been in debt, who's free of debt, someone who's recovered from a fever, someone's released from prison, someone who has now been released from slavery, someone who's now found a way back home. And so there's a great sense of well-being, which matures into rapture, and the jhana factors begin to appear in the mind. So samadhi begins where the five hindrances end. The five hindrances are hindrances both to the stability and clarity and inner tranquility of mind, and also to the wisdom faculty. So working with the five hindrances, understanding them, and learning ways of dealing with them effectively is the most important work of meditation. So that's my discourse for this afternoon, and I'd like to end it at this point.